Chapter 2. The Tree of Life. In the Tree of Life, built from comparisons of nucleotide sequence in genes from diverse organisms, plants and animals form only small twigs near the top of one branch. Life's greater diversity, and by implication, its deeper history, is microbial. If we wish to explore Precambrian rocks for evidence of early life, we must first learn about bacteria and archaea, the tiny architects of terrestrial ecosystems. Most of us learn about Richard III through Shakespeare's eponymous drama, but as history, this account is suspect. After all, Shakespeare's patrons won the War of the Roses. Biased, selective, incomplete, and even incomprehensible documents are the daily bread of historians. Despite the shortcomings of individual accounts, however, scholars can arrive at a balanced understanding of the past by sifting through a number of different records for points of agreement and complementary perspectives. The study of biological history works much the same way. The fossiliferous cliffs along the Cotuican River served to introduce one great library of Earth's evolutionary past, the geological record. Sedimentary rocks preserve a remarkable record of life and environments through time, but as we've already observed, this accounting is episodic, not continuous. It is also highly selective, brightly illuminating some groups of organisms while leaving others in darkness. For example, we know a great deal about the paleontology of horses, but little about the earthworms beneath their feet. Fortunately, we can consult a second library, the biological diversity that surrounds us today. Comparative biology offers rich resources for evolutionary analysis, providing genealogy to complement paleontology's record of time and physiology to match geology's chronicle of environmental change. The great cell biologist Christian de Duve has gone so far as to suggest that the genes of living organisms contain a full accounting of evolutionary history. If so, however, it is, like Shakespeare's histories, limited to an account of life's winners. Only paleontology can tell us about trilobites, dinosaurs, and other biological wonders that no longer grace the earth. If we wish to understand life's history, then, we must weave together insights drawn from geology and comparative biology, using living organisms to reanimate fossils and fossils to learn how the diversity of our own moment came to be. Despite an almost bewildering diversity of form and function, all cells share a common core of molecular features, including ATP, life's principal energy currency, DNA, RNA, a common, with a few minor exceptions, genetic code, molecular machinery for transcribing genetic information from DNA into RNA, and more machinery to translate RNA messages into proteins that provide structure and regulate cell function. The reciprocal observation is equally striking. In spite of their fundamental unity of molecular structure, organisms display extraordinary variation in size, shape, physiology, and behavior. Life's unity and diversity are both remarkable in their own ways. Together, they comprise the two great themes of comparative biology. Even a casual observer will notice the pattern of nested similarity displayed by Earth's biological diversity. Humans and chimpanzees are clearly distinct, but they share many features of anatomy and physiology, resembling each other far more than either does, say, a horse. Humans, chimps, and horses, in turn, share features such as hair, lungs, and limbs that separate them from catfish. Yet all animals with bony skeletons share a basic pattern of anatomical organization that unites them as a group and differentiates them from other sets of species built on different design principles. Insects, for example, or spiders. The nested similarity of species was well known to early naturalists. Linnaeus codified it in the 1730s, proposing a hierarchical system of taxonomic classification that is still in use today. It was Charles Darwin, however, who explicitly recognized the genealogical nature of this pattern. "Biological differences have arisen through time," he wrote, "because of descent with modification, that is, by evolutionary divergence from common ancestors under the influence of natural selection. The affinities of all the beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. I believe this simile largely speaks the truth. The green and budding twigs may represent existing species, and those produced during each former year may represent the long succession of extinct species. As buds give rise by growth to fresh buds, and these, if vigorous, branch out and overtop on all sides many a feebler branch, so by generation I believe it has been with the great tree of life, which fills with its dead and broken branches the crust of the earth, and covers the surface with its ever-branching and beautiful ramifications." We can explain the similarities between humans and chimps by descent from a common ancestor that possessed the various features the two groups share. Their differences have arisen since they diverged. This makes the paleontological prediction that the oldest fossils of human-like primates should resemble the last common ancestor of chimps and humans more closely than modern people do. The features that make us distinctly human should appear only in younger fossils of our lineage. The fossil record of human ancestry is notoriously sketchy, but skeletal remains unearthed in Africa and Asia confirm this prediction. Note that there is no expectation that successively older members of our lineage should close in on chimp morphology. Humans didn't descend from chimpanzees. Humans and chimps both diverged from a common ancestor that was neither Homo nor Pan. Not all shared features are equally helpful in determining propinquity of descent, another delightful Darwinism. For example, birds, bats, and the extinct pterosaurs all sport wings, but their wings have different skeletal structures, and many other features show that these airborne animals are not closely related. Wings evolved independently in each group as an adaptation for flight. In the parlance of systematic biology, these features are convergent. Only features that are shared because of common ancestry, homologies in evolution speak, can be used to assess evolutionary relationships. In practice, we don't always know whether similar features are convergent or homologous, and so rely on sophisticated computer algorithms to sort out large sets of comparative biological data. It is relatively easy to see how morphological characteristics might be used to articulate a hypothesis of evolutionary relatedness, or phylogeny, for all primates, all mammals, or even all vertebrate animals. We can also grant that an expert at least could do the same for mollusks or arthropods. But how can we place mollusks, arthropods, and vertebrates within a greater evolutionary tree of all animals? And much harder, how can we reconstruct the whole of Darwin's great tree of life, a phylogeny that encompasses all living things? Wandering through an alpine forest or snorkeling above a coral reef, we observe an ecology shaped by plants, or seaweeds, and animals, with large vertebrates at the top of the food chain and other creatures below. Ecosystems also contain many organisms that we can't see, but concern for their contributions is generally fleeting. Surely bacteria and other microorganisms, tiny and simple, eke out their living in a world of our making? As large animals, we can be forgiven for holding a worldview that celebrates ourselves, but in truth, this outlook is dead wrong. We have evolved to fit into a bacterial world, and not the reverse. Why this should be is in part a question of history, but it is also an issue of diversity and ecosystem function. Animals may be evolution's icing, but bacteria are the cake. Plants, animals, fungi, algae, and protozoa are eukaryotic organisms, genealogically linked by a pattern of cell organization in which genetic material occurs within a membrane-bounded structure called the nucleus. Bacteria and other prokaryotes are different. Their cells lack nuclei. In terms of biological importance, eukaryotes would seem to have a decisive edge. Eukaryotic organisms display a variety of form that ranges from scorpions, elephants, and toadstools to dandelions, kelps, and amoebas. In contrast, prokaryotes are mostly minute spheres, rods, or corkscrews. Some bacteria form simple filaments of cells joined end to end, but very few are able to build more complicated multicellular structures. Size and shape surely favor eukaryotes, but morphology provides only one of several yardsticks for measuring ecological significance. Metabolism, how an organism obtains materials and energy, is another, and by this criterion, it is the prokaryotes that dazzle with their diversity. Eukaryotic organisms basically make a living in one of three ways. Organisms like ourselves are heterotrophs. We gain both the carbon and energy needed for growth by ingesting organic molecules made by other organisms. To obtain energy, our cells use oxygen to break down sugars to carbon dioxide and water, a process called aerobic, oxygen-using respiration. In a pinch, we can gain a bit of energy from a second metabolism called fermentation, an anaerobic, no-oxygen process in which one organic molecule is broken into two others. Only brewer's yeast and a few other eukaryotes make much of a living this way. The third principal energy metabolism found in eukaryotes is the photosynthesis performed by plants and algae. Chlorophyll and associated pigments harvest energy from sunlight, enabling plants to fix carbon dioxide into organic matter. In order to convert light into biochemical energy, plants need an electron. Water supplies the needed charge, producing oxygen as a byproduct. A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens's classic tale of redemption, opens with an admonition for readers to pay close attention to a particular fact. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. This must be distinctly understood, or nothing wonderful can come of the story I am going to relate. The early history of life has its own Jacob Marley facts that, like the old miser's death in Dickens's story, need to be understood if the narrative is to make sense. First of these is the metabolic diversity of prokaryotic microorganisms, key to any exploration of early biological history. We must come to grips with the many ways that prokaryotes make a living and how these tiny organisms fit onto the tree of life before we put our boots back on and return to the field as paleontologists. Like eukaryotes, many bacteria respire using oxygen. But other bacteria can respire using dissolved nitrate, NO3-, instead, and still others use sulfate, SO4-2-, ions, or the metallic oxides of iron and manganese. A few prokaryotes can even use CO2 to react with acetic acid, generating natural gas, which is methane, CH4. Prokaryotic organisms have also evolved a galaxy of fermentation reactions. Bacteria ring changes on the theme of photosynthesis as well. The cyanobacteria, a group of photosynthetic bacteria tinted blue-green by chlorophyll and other pigments, harvest sunlight and fix CO2, much like eukaryotic algae and land plants. However, when hydrogen sulfide, H2S, well known for its rotten egg smell, is present, many cyanobacteria use this gas rather than water to supply the electrons needed for photosynthesis. Sulfur and sulfate are formed as byproducts, but oxygen is not. The cyanobacteria comprise only one of five distinct groups of photosynthetic bacteria. In the other groups, electron supply by H2S, hydrogen gas, H2, or organic molecules is obligatory, and oxygen is never produced. These photosynthetic bacteria harvest light using bacteriochlorophyll rather than the more familiar chlorophyll. Some employ the same biochemistry as cyanobacteria and green plants to fix carbon dioxide, but others have distinctly different pathways, and still others rely on carbon already packaged into organic molecules. Bacterial variations on the metabolic themes of respiration, fermentation, and photosynthesis are thus impressive, but prokaryotic organisms have evolved yet another way of growing that is completely unknown in eukaryotes, chemosynthesis. Like photosynthetic organisms, chemosynthetic microbes get their carbon from CO2, but they harvest energy from chemical reactions rather than sunlight. Oxygen or nitrate, or less commonly, sulfate, oxidized iron, or manganese, is combined with hydrogen gas, methane, or reduced forms of iron, sulfur, and nitrogen in ways that allow the cell to capture the energy released by the reaction. Methanogenic prokaryotes are of particular evolutionary and ecological interest. These tiny cells can gain energy from the reaction of hydrogen gas and carbon dioxide to produce methane. The metabolic pathways of prokaryotes sustain the chemical cycles that maintain Earth as a habitable planet. Take carbon dioxide, for example. Volcanoes supply CO2 to the oceans and atmosphere, but photosynthesis removes it at a far faster clip. So much faster, in fact, that photosynthetic organisms could strip the present-day atmosphere of its CO2 in little more than a decade. They don't, of course, principally because respiration, in essence, runs the photosynthetic reaction backward. While photosynthetic organisms react CO2 and water to produce sugar and oxygen, respiring creatures, including you as you are hearing this sentence, react sugar with oxygen, giving off water and carbon dioxide. Together, photosynthesis and respiration cycle carbon through the biosphere, sustaining life and maintaining the environment through time. It is easy to envision a simple carbon cycle in which cyanobacteria fix CO2 into organic matter and supply oxygen to the environment, while respiring bacteria do the reverse, consuming oxygen and regenerating CO2. Plants and algae would do just as well as cyanobacteria, and protozoa, fungi, and animals could substitute for bacterial respirers. The prokaryotes and eukaryotes are functionally equivalent. But let's let some cells sink to the seafloor and become buried in oxygen-depleted sediments. Now the limitations of eukaryotic metabolism become clear. Reactions that do not use oxygen, anaerobic reactions, are needed to complete the carbon cycle. In modern seafloor sediments, sulfate reduction and respiration using iron and manganese are just as important as aerobic respiration in recycling organic matter. More generally, wherever carbon passes through oxygen-free environments, bacteria are essential to the carbon cycle. Eukaryotes are everywhere optional. The fundamental importance of prokaryotes extends to other biologically important elements as well. Indeed, in the biogeochemical cycles of sulfur and nitrogen, all the principal metabolic pathways that cycle these elements are prokaryotic. Consider in particular nitrogen, an essential element required for the formation of proteins, nucleic acids, and other biological compounds. We live our lives bathed in nitrogen gas. Air is about 80% N2 by volume. But this vast repository of nitrogen is not biologically available to us. Like other animals, we obtain the nitrogen we need by eating other organisms. As it turns out, nitrogen gas is no more available to cattle or corn than it is to humans. Plants can take up ammonium, NH4+, or nitrate from the soil, but how do these compounds get there in the first place? Ammonium is released as dead cells decay. Nitrate, in turn, is produced by bacteria that oxidize ammonium. In oxygen-rich habitats, the resulting nitrate is available to plants, or in aquatic ecosystems, algae and cyanobacteria. But in waterlogged soil or other environments where O2 is depleted, Other bacteria use nitrate for respiration, returning nitrogen to the atmospheric pool of N2. Much of the nitrate spread across fields as fertilizer is lost in this way. So, we haven't solved our problem. The ammonium and nitrate in soil and seawater come from dead cells, and nitrate-respiring bacteria inexorably remove biologically usable nitrogen from the environment. What, then, fuels the biological nitrogen cycle and keeps it from running down? The answer is that some organisms are able to convert atmospheric nitrogen to ammonium using the cell's store of energy. No eukaryotic organism can fix nitrogen in this way, but many prokaryotes can. Farmers commonly include soy or other beans in their crop rotation because these plants restore nitrogen to the soil. The task of nitrogen fixation, however, is accomplished by bacteria that live in small nodules on the roots of bean plants, not by the beans themselves. A small amount of nitrogen is fixed by lightning as it cuts through the atmosphere, but biology's thirst for nitrogen is quenched mainly by bacteria. The cycles of carbon, nitrogen, sulfur, and other elements are linked together into a complex system that controls the biological pulse of the planet. Because organisms need nitrogen for proteins and other molecules, there could be no carbon cycle without nitrogen fixation. Nitrogen metabolism itself depends on enzymes that contain iron. Thus, without biologically available iron, there could be no nitrogen cycle, and hence no carbon cycle. Biology on another planet may or may not include organisms that are large or intelligent, but wherever it persists for long periods of time, life will feature complementary metabolisms that cycle biologically important elements through the biosphere. By now, it should be apparent why I insisted earlier that plants and animals evolved to fit into a prokaryotic world rather than the reverse. It is a prokaryotic world, and not only in the trivial sense that there are a lot of bacterial cells. Prokaryotic metabolisms form the fundamental ecological circuitry of life. Bacteria, not mammals, underpin the efficient and long-term functioning of the biosphere. How can this astonishing diversity of prokaryotic cells be ordered and assembled along with that of eukaryotes into a phylogeny that encompasses all of biology? Size and shape fail us, and so does physiology. Organisms as disparate as fungi and elephants, or E. coli and redwoods, are simply too different from one another to assemble into a believable tree based on form and function alone. The solution requires that we return to the unity of life, the molecular attributes shared by all known organisms. In a groundbreaking paper published in 1965, Emil Zuckerkandel and Nobel laureate Linus Pauling proposed that molecules can be read as documents of evolutionary history. Just as the anatomical structures of limbs or skulls reflect descent with modification, so too do the chemical structures of DNA and proteins. The long chain of amino acids that makes up, say, the respiratory protein cytochrome C differs slightly between humans and chimps, and more so between humans, chimps, and horses. The sequences of nucleotides in the genes that code for these proteins differ correspondingly. Carl Woese of the University of Illinois built decisively on this conceptual foundation. Woese spent his formative years in science investigating ribosomes, the sites within cells where proteins are manufactured. He knew that all organisms contain ribosomes, that all ribosomes contain functional complexes made of RNA and proteins, and that these complexes all contain several subunits. By comparing among organisms the sequences of nucleotides that make up the RNA molecules found in the small subunit of ribosomes, Woese made the great leap that brought phylogeny to the microbial world, sowing the seeds for a tree of life worthy of the name. Figure 2.1 shows the tree of life, a depiction of the genealogical relationships of all living organisms based on comparisons of molecular sequence in the genes that code for small subunit ribosomal RNA. Experts argue about its details, but all biologists agree that our ability to draw Darwin's great tree of life in its entirety constitutes one of the great intellectual achievements of the late 20th century. The first thing to notice about the tree is that it contains three major limbs, termed domains by Woese. Two of the domains are unsurprising. The eukaryotes and the bacteria fall on distinct branches. The third, however, came as a shock when Woese and then postdoctoral fellow George Fox proposed it in 1977. The archaea are prokaryotic in cell organization, and for many years the organisms on this branch had been thought of, when they were thought about at all, as metabolically unusual bacteria. But comparison of ribosomal RNA genes suggests that these microbes are fully as distinct from the conventional bacteria as bacteria are from eukaryotes. What's more, the tree indicates that archaeans are actually more closely related to the eukaryotes than they are to bacteria. In phylogenetic discourse, closeness of relationship reflects recency of common ancestry. It is a statement about genealogy, not similarity. The complete genome, genetic information encoded in DNA, of the archaean Methanococcus yanasii was published in 1996, revealing that this microbe shares just 11-17% of its genes with bacteria whose genomes have been sequenced. More than 50% of its genes are unknown in either eukaryotes or bacteria, confirming that archaeans are distinctly different from organisms in the other two domains. Archaeans do, however, have some important characters in common with bacteria, such as, most obviously, prokaryotic cell organization, the molecular structure of the ribosome, and the arrangement of genes on a single circular chromosome. Equally, on the other hand, archaeans share attributes such as molecular details of DNA transcription and susceptibility to specific antibiotics with eukaryotes. And there are still other traits that bacteria and eukaryotes share to the exclusion of archaea. Prominent among these is the nature of the cell membrane. How then do we tell who is more closely related to whom? Put another way, where do we place the root on this tree? A three-branched tree can't be rooted by conventional means, and a bit more consideration of character distributions shows why. Features such as ATP or the genetic code that are shared by all three domains carry no information on genealogical relationships, but permit inferences about the nature of the last common ancestor of the three branches. In contrast, attributes such as cell wall composition that are distinct in each limb provide no information on either genealogy or ancestral features. Characters shared by two of the three domains would appear to offer better prospects for tree building, but such distributions can be explained equally well in several different ways. For example, if we assume that membranes composed of fatty acids were present in the last common ancestor, then we can posit that this trait was retained in bacteria and eukaryotes, but replaced by isoprenoid-based membranes along the road to the archaea. Alternatively, we can assume that membranes built from isoprenoids are ancestral, but were swapped for fatty acid membranes in the common ancestor of bacteria and eukaryotes. Like the first alternative, this tree requires only one evolutionary change. We could, of course, eliminate some possibilities if we knew for certain which traits characterized the last common ancestor, but we have no way of determining this. A clever solution to the rooting problem was proposed in 1989. Two research groups headed by Naoyuki Iwabe and Peter Gogarten, respectively, independently recognized that while three sets of organisms cannot be joined into a rooted tree, some of the genes they contain can be. The genes in question share a specific property. They were present in duplicate sets in the last common ancestor. How does this help us? As shown in Figure 2.2, each of the two sister genes present in the last common ancestor diverged as the three domains differentiated. The resulting array of genes can be ordered into a tree. In toto, the tree is unrooted, but it consists of two component branches that can be rooted relative to each other. Both half-trees have the same form, one branch that contains only bacteria, and a second containing archaea plus eukaryotes. This exercise has been repeated numerous times using dozens of gene families. Many trees yield the root position shown in Figure 2.2, but others suggest different relationships among the three domains. No one tree satisfies all genetic data, forcing a startling conclusion. We think about genes being passed vertically through the tree from ancestor to descendant, but some genes must have been passed horizontally from one branch to another, perhaps by hopping a ride on a virus or by the uptake of DNA from dead cells. Contemporary organisms are, thus, genetic chimeras. This revelation potentially casts doubt on the entire endeavor of constructing phylogenies from gene sequences, because gene trees and organism trees will not coincide when horizontal transfer has occurred. According to some biological Cassandras, the genes of microorganisms have been swapped so often and so promiscuously that no meaningful tree of microbial organisms can be recovered from molecular comparisons. This possibility is both frustrating and tantalizing, but it may be overdrawn. Sorrel Fitzgibbons of UCLA and Christopher House, now at Penn State, analyzed the distribution of all genes in the dozen or so organisms whose complete genomes had been sequenced by early 1999. The tree recovered by comparing universal gene distributions closely matches that inferred from ribosomal RNA gene sequences, suggesting that despite gene swapping, phylogenetic order underpins the genomes of bacteria and archaeans. James Lake and Maria Riviera, also of UCLA, have even hypothesized that certain rules govern the likelihood of horizontal transfer. Informational genes that code for basic features of cell biology appear to be unlikely candidates for lateral exchange. Ribosomal RNA genes fall into this category. In contrast, operational genes or groups of genes that encode specific metabolic functions, may be passed from one lineage to another with relative ease by means of viruses or other vectors. For example, we know that bacterial tolerance to heavy metals can be gained by the uptake of particular genes. Dawn is just breaking on the study of microbial genes and phylogeny, and as more and more genomes are sequenced in their entirety, new insights can be expected to topple current generalizations. For now, it is reasonable to view the tree of life as a reflection of microbial genealogy. But we must think of it as a genealogy of the microbial chassis, with specific features that soup up well-adapted organisms assembled, in part, by gene exchange across taxa. The bacterial limb of the tree is profusely branched. At present, we know of at least 30 major groups of bacteria, each more or less equivalent to the plant and animal kingdoms traditionally recognized by biologists. Most of the diverse metabolisms discussed in the previous section can be found on this limb. In particular, photosynthesis is a distinctly bacterial physiology. How this squares with the obvious presence of photosynthesis in eukaryotic plants and algae is one of the great stories of evolutionary biology, but a tale best left for Chapter 8. Note, however, that photosynthetic lineages adorn only the upper branches of the bacterial limb. This suggests that Earth's earliest ecosystems were fundamentally different from those that surround us today. Today, photosynthesis fuels biology in most habitats. Early life, however, must have run on chemosynthesis. The earliest branches currently recognized on the bacterial limb contain chemosynthetic and heterotrophic organisms, many of which live at high temperatures in the absence or near absence of oxygen. In contrast to bacteria, the archaea contain only two principal groups, albeit with hints of others yet to be characterized. One branch of archaeans is dominated by methanogenic organisms. Most bugs on this branch are obligate methane producers, but in at least three instances, individual lineages have evolved a more diverse metabolic repertoire that includes respiration. According to Gary Olson of the University of Illinois, these add-ons are all encoded by genes transferred horizontally from bacteria. This emphasizes that horizontal transfer isn't something that occurred once or twice in the earliest history of life. It is a continuing and persistent means of creating biological novelty. Closely related to the methanogenic archaeans are the halobacteria, a distinctive group of microorganisms that gain energy from the sun, using a light-harvesting pigment strikingly similar to the rhodopsin in vertebrate eyes. Halobacteria obtain the carbon they need to grow by absorbing organic molecules. The other major branch of the archaea includes organisms that derive energy from chemical reactions between hydrogen and sulfur compounds. Archaea are widely distributed across the Earth, but we still know relatively little about most of them. For example, only in 2001 was it discovered that tiny archaeans may be the most abundant organisms in many parts of the ocean. Biologists have no idea how these microbes make their living. On the other hand, some of the best characterized archaea live in unusual places, very unusual places. The halobacteria, for example, thrive in waters that are 10 times saltier than the ocean. The striking magenta sheen of halobacteria can be seen from the air in commercial salt ponds, such as those that line the landing approach to San Francisco Airport. Other archaeans live in acid mine waste with a pH of 1. And the current world record holder for temperature tolerance is Pyrolobus fumarii, an archaean that can grow in deep-sea hydrothermal vents at 113 degrees Celsius. At the high pressures of the ocean bottom, water this hot remains liquid. These hyperthermophilic organisms cannot grow at the temperatures used to pasteurize milk, not because they are too hot, but because they are too cold. How do we think about such extremophiles? Are they merely fascinating oddballs, or do they tell us something fundamental about the history of life? Some, such as the halophiles, reside on distal branches of the tree of life, implying that these groups evolved relatively late in its history. In contrast, hyperthermophilic prokaryotes occupy a privileged position in the tree. They are found on the earliest branches of both the archaeal and bacterial limbs. This suggests that modern organisms are descended from ancestors that lived in hot environments. Thus, when we encounter microbial communities in the colorful hot springs of Yellowstone Park or in the mid-ocean ridges that traverse the deep seafloor, we are glimpsing some of our earliest ancestors. Recently, geneticists have added an intriguing twist to this story. The amino acid sequences in proteins from living microorganisms can be used to reconstruct ancient proteins likely to have been present in the last common ancestor. Surprisingly, the putatively ancestral proteins synthesized from these reconstructions are not stable at high temperatures. If true, the last common ancestor of bacteria and archaeans could not have been hyperthermophilic at all. How to reconcile this finding with the tree of life remains a subject of debate. One possibility is that the earliest organisms evolved at moderate temperatures, but gave rise to at least two groups of descendants that colonized energy-rich hot springs. Now all we need is an exterminating angel to wipe out all life, save the handful of lineages sheltered in hydrothermal foxholes. Giant meteor impacts would do nicely, and crater histories of the Moon and Mars indicate that early in its history, before 3.9 billion years ago, the inner solar system was pummeled again and again by gigantic meteors. Earth could not have escaped this drubbing. Indeed, Norman Sleep of Stanford University long ago proposed that life's only refuge on the primitive Earth would have been hydrothermal vents in the deep seafloor. Thus, the deepest branches of the tree may tell us of both evolution and extinction when life was young. As implied earlier, the Tree of Life provides a roadmap for history of life, its branching order reflecting the successive radiations of biological diversity. The tree suggests that early ecosystems were centered on hydrothermal vent and spring systems, with the later appearance of photosynthesis enabling life to spread across the planet. Large, complex organisms like plants and animals are evolutionary latecomers, confined to distal twigs on a eukaryotic branch, formed mainly by microscopic organisms. There is another way to interpret the tree. Because organisms in general, and microorganisms in particular, are commonly tied to specific habitats, the tree can be read as an environmental history of the Earth. For example, most early branching organisms do not use oxygen in metabolism, and many are killed by exposure to O2 at even part per million levels. Organisms that can thrive when oxygen is present in moderate amounts branch later, and only at the tips of the tree do we find organisms like ourselves that require oxygen in high concentrations. The Tree of Life, thus, makes predictions about Earth history that can be tested against the geological record. The first essential point of the tree is that the organisms and environments of our common experience are relatively recent features. The deep history of life is microbial. The other main point is that life has not evolved on a static planetary surface. Rather, life and environments have evolved together throughout our planet's history, inexorably linked by the biogeochemical cycles in which both participate. Armed with predictions from comparative biology, we can turn our attention back to the Cambrian explosion, captured so vividly in the cliffs along the Cotuican River. The Tree of Life supports Charles Darwin's intuition that the Cambrian radiation of animals must have been preceded by a long antecedent history of life. Paleontologists wishing to reconstruct this history must focus on rocks deposited before the Cambrian period, on pre-Cambrian rocks that document Earth's early planetary development. We also need to replace zoological search images by pictures drawn from microbiology. But bacteria, archaeans, and simple eukaryotic microorganisms are tiny and fragile. Can we really expect them to have left an interpretable fossil record?